All right, good evening, everyone.
Hanukkah's coming, Mirtz Hashem, Wednesday night. So what you have in front of you is the sheet, the text, the story of Noah and his vineyard. The actual text that's in front of you is a relatively simple story. What is it, maybe 10, 11 psukim long, the entire thing, the entire story of Noah as he exits the Teva. He plants himself a vineyard, as we see. He gets drunk. And the episodes unfold from there, which we'll study. What does this have to do with Hanukkah? Hanukkah is a fascinating yontif. Hanukkah, as we know, is the yontif, as we refer to it, as a yontif derabbanan. It's a rabbinic holiday. We won't find it anywhere in the Torah. The Torah does not command us to light Hanukkah candles. And the reason for that is obvious, because the episode, the incident, that which we are commemorating, the Hanukkah story, takes place way after the Torah is already completed and the Jews have been living in Eretz Yisrael. Not only have they been living in Eretz Yisrael, they've already been exiled from Eretz Yisrael. They've come back to Eretz Yisrael, and this story takes place during the Second Temple period. So you're not going to find the mitzvah of Hanukkah in the Torah. Except what's fascinating about this particular yontif is the amount of references that we find that the sages and Chazal saw in the Torah to the Hanukkah story. So that woven into the fabric of the Torah is the concept of Hanukkah, as we'll see. And that is going to be very significant. Let me just start with two of the places where we find them. One is more familiar than the other. But they're not just that Chazal find references, but that they find references in significant seminal moments in the Torah. So it's not just a hint here or a hint there. For example, in the Purim story, the Torah also asks, where do we find Purim in the Torah? And there, all that the Gemara does is it finds a word, Hamin Ha'et, from the tree did you eat, where we find the word Haman, or we find Haster, Astir, the word Esther, or Mordechai. So there are references that we find in the Torah to Purim. But what we're going to find by Hanukkah, particularly by this story, is that at seminal points in our time, in our history, in the Torah story, we have references to this concept. For example, the very second pasuk in the entire Torah. So it begins, Bereshis, Bara, Elokim, Yisra, Shemayim, Vard, the beginning, Hashem created heaven and earth. V'ha'aret ha'isa sohu v'avohu v'choshech al p'nei sahom. And the earth, in the beginning of time, was sohu vavohu, was desolate, it was void, and there was darkness over the deep. Chazal Darshan, those words, why does the Torah describe the beginning of our time, the beginning of the universe, so to speak, with those terms of void and darkness, empty, deep? So Chazal understand the word desolate. Sohu is a reference to Golus Bavel. The four exiles that the Jewish people will go through are hinted at in this particular phrase. In the very beginning of time, in the beginning of the creation of the universe, we have a reference to the four exiles. Number one, Golus Bavel, from the word Sohu. Vavohu, and it was void. That's a reference to the Golus of Madai, the second of our exiles. Choshech is a reference to Golus Yavon, the exile of the Greeks, which is the exile of the Hanukkah story. Choshech, a time of darkness. And Tahom, the deep, is a reference to the Golus of Edom, the Roman exile, which is the exile that we are still in at this point in time. For 2,000 years now, we have been in the exile of Rome, waiting to be able to get out of this particular exile. Okay, no one else can come. Now, when Chazal tell us that there are four exiles, and it tells us this, that the Torah is telling us in the beginning of time, that means to say it's not just that there are a couple of mistakes that are going to be made and that we're going to be exiled, but a part of the fabric of creation, part of the process of the Jewish people from the beginning of time, from the beginning of creation to perfection, to the time that we will enter into the state of the Mashiach, this is part of the journey of the Jewish people, and it's embedded in creation. It's from the very beginning. From the second pasuk in the Torah, we're ready have the concept, we're going to have these four exiles, the process that the Jewish people are going to have to go through, and Choshech, darkness, the story of Hanukkah, Yavon, the Gemara says, that's one of the exiles. Already rooted in the very beginning of the story, we have a hint of this particular exile. When Avram Avinu is given the Bris Ben Abisarim, his covenant, and he's told his children are going to go down into exile for 400 years before Hashem takes them out, so the Torah describes v'hinei ema chashecha gedola nofelus alav, a great and awesome darkness fell upon Avraham as he receives this prophecy. And then Hashem says to him, yadoa teida, you need to know that your children are going to be in exile for 400 years, they're going to be afflicted, but then I'm going to take them out. The Torah uses that graphic description that Avraham was with a great and awesome darkness that fell upon him. And Chazal saw in that phrase as well a reference to the four exiles of the Jewish people. At a seminal moment in our history, where Avram Avinu is being told, your children will go down into exile, and then I will take them out, Birchush Gadol, and bring them to Eretz Yisrael. And in that phrase, in that prophecy is, they'll be exiled, there'll be redemption, and we have in that the fabric of four exiles that his future generations would go through. One of them, of course, being darkness, Choshech, the great darkness that fell upon Avram. That's the Choshech of Golos Yavon, the exile of the Greeks, the Hanukkah story, again embedded in the story of the Torah, that seminal moment of Avram receiving this prophecy. We find Hanukkah reference as well in the menorah, where Aharon was saddened, and Hashem gives Aharon the mitzvah of lighting the menorah. As the Ramban comments, that was actually a reference to the menorah for the ones that we light as well. Without getting into the details of that particular reference, we find the story of Hanukkah throughout the Chumash. It plays itself in a lot of the Yosef and Yehuda stories that we're reading about in the Parshios now. So one of the stories that I want to go through, where we also find the beginnings of this story, the process of Hanukkah is going to be part of our ultimate redemption. We must go through this particular exile to come out with the lessons that we need to experience it, to succeed, and then to carry that with us. One of the references that we have, which is not as overt as Chazal Sihi, but we will see it as a clear beginnings of the story of Hanukkah, is this story of Noach and his vineyard. That's what we want to study. We'll start it today. We'll go through the actual story with the goal of focusing not so much on the story as a whole, which can be an independent study, but trying to pick out the parts of that as it references and relates to the Hanukkah story. Now, the blurb that you all saw in the Shabbos flyer referenced a specific law. And that law was the specific law that a Sefer Torah is allowed to be written in Greek, which is a fascinating halacha. It doesn't apply today, by the way, because the Greek language today is not the pure Greek language that it once was. The very first Torah, of course, you know, was translated into Greek. The Septuagint was actually the first translation of the Torah. The Gemara says that when the Torah was translated, darkness descended upon the world, and Eretz Yisrael quivered 400 amos by 400 amos, and now the Torah had actually been translated into another language. But that language of Greek, the Gemara calls a beautiful language. And as such, that was the only language you could actually write a Sefer Torah in Greek, which is, it's just unfathomable to us today that a single letter is missing from a Sefer Torah. There's a crack in a letter, and a vav is not attached because a piece of ink has chipped away, and we'll say the whole Torah is not valid. And you can write a whole entire Torah in Greek. It is mind-boggling. And the source of that particular law will come out of this story as well. And that's going to be the springboard. There's a connection between that beauty of Greece, which has a place in Torah, and has an application, and it comes out of this story. And from that uncovering of that story, we'll have a picture of the Hanukkah story as a whole. Not the only picture. There are many references that we just went through, a couple of them where we find Hanukkah in the Torah, and they all fit together in a big scheme. We're just going to focus on this particular little story at this time. Okay, with that as background, that's one of the shortest backgrounds I've ever given to a class, less than 15 minutes. With that background, let's get started. So we're going to actually just learn the story, and then through that we'll get back to the Hanukkah story. Mostly today we'll be focused on this story, but we'll get back to it a little bit. Does everyone have a sheath? Make more copies, are we okay? Okay, the backdrop of this story is, this is right after they exit from the Teva. Noah and his sons and their wives have been on the ark for the full year. The world has been destroyed, and they then come out and emerge. This is in the middle of the ninth Perek Tes, the ninth chapter. Hashem commands them to go out. He blesses them. He blesses Noach. He blesses the three sons. He tells them to be fruitful, to be multiply, and to fill the world. We have the covenant of the rainbow takes place at this point. And then we have our particular story. So this is who's in the world right now. It's Noach and his three sons, and they are going to repopulate the world. Vayu b'nei Noach, hayotzim min ha-teva, shem, chom, v'yofes. Says the Chumash 18, the sons of Noach who came out from the ark were Shem, Chom, and Yofes. V'cham hu avi Kanan. So we're going to go through the psukim. We'll raise a lot of questions. We'll answer some of them. When I like to do these textual studies, I like to define different types of questions. Any of you have been through any of the other classes, either on the Garden of Eden or Cain and Hevel. So you have big questions and little questions. This is as Rabbi David Foreman likes to define them. The big questions are the types of questions that if you can't answer this question, you don't understand the story. The type of question that says this, if someone sits down to you and says, and I was just reading the story of the Garden of Eden, and I can't figure out, why would God create a fruit and tell man not to eat it? Good question. If you can't answer that question, if you can't address a fundamental, like, that's a great question. Why did the snake want Eve to eat the fruit? Great question. Never thought of that before. Well, you can't possibly claim to understand the story if you can't answer certain questions like that. Smaller questions, why did he use this word in the verse as opposed to that word? Or those are good questions, important questions, but we can distinguish between the questions that we can continue on and that if we don't understand, we can't answer. We just don't understand the story without being able to answer these particular questions. But let's ask all types of questions. We'll probably put aside most of the smaller questions and try to address the bigger questions, but we'll just throw them out as we go along. But anyway, the first verse in our story tells us, introduces us again to the sons of Noach. Now we already know this. This is the first verse on our sheet. But those of you who know that this is not the beginning of the Chumash, that there's actually verses which come before this, are well aware that this is not the first time we've been introduced to Noach's three sons. We actually have introduced them many times already, and we know that their names are Shem, Ham, and Yafes. And here we are told not only that, but that Ham, hu avi Kanan. Ham is the father of Kanan. So we're now told a link to the next generation, that Ham has a child and his name is Kanan. And this is who exited, came out from the Teva. Yotes 19, Shlosha Eila b'nei Noach, u'me Eila nachzachol ha'aretz. These three were the sons of Noach, and from these the whole world was spread out. What's the Torah stressing with this fact? Right, this is it. Torah wants you to stress and to tell us again, every single being that will exist in the world will be descended from these three children. Noah, by the end of the story, will not have any more children. This is going to be it for him. These three, and he's done. So that every other living human being that will ever exist will have been descended from one of these three children. Now, that's pretty significant. Obviously, that this is the whole world population. Now, foreshadowing the end of the story, this is a story which you read every year but probably don't pay much attention to. By the end of the story, the three sons will either be blessed or cursed by Noah. Each one of them will receive something, and then Noah is going to die, and at the end we hear we're finished with Noah. So now we have a role that Noah will attribute to each one of these three sons, and the Torah has told us at the beginning of the story that you should know, this is it. Each one of these three will now represent something, and in its representation, the whole world will spread out from one of these three links, one of these three branches will be the entire world. Chaf 20. Vayechal Noach, Isha Adama Vayita Karem. Noach, the man of the earth. Now there are two ways to translate the word vayachel, which I have here on the English side. Vayachel means two things. Sometimes it means lehatchil, which means to begin. Now, so lehatchil or vayachel can mean a beginning, a haschala. It also means the word vayachel can mean from the word of chulin, or chul, which is chol, like weekday, profane, not sanctified, debasing oneself, or emptiness. So, what does it mean when the Torah says, Vayochel Noach? So we'll see, it's going to mean a little combination of both. We could either translate it as, Noach, the man of the earth, began and planted a vineyard. This was, after all, the beginning. This is one of the first acts that we find Noach doing and engaging in after exiting from the Teva. But Chazal will see in the fact that the Torah chose that specific word to begin the planting of the vineyard, a debasing of himself. As Rashi comments, he should have planted something else. This wasn't where he should have started. The first thing that he does is he plants a vineyard. It should have been something else, and in that act, that this is where he started, an element of debasing himself. So he's beginning, and as he begins, He debases himself. It's something a little less than what he should have done, Chazal see in this first act. And what he does is he plants a vineyard. Now, one of the questions that we would have to ask here would be, or better, simpler, why? I mean, why is he planting a vineyard? What is it that drove Noach, after exiting the Teva, that this is what he wants? Do you have an answer? Okay. Now, that's as much as Webinar, I don't know if he might have meant that totally seriously. But that is not to be underestimated in the sense that Noach witnessed the destruction of the world. Now, we are so familiar with that story. If you think about a child's perspective of Noach and the Teva, what would a child think about Noach and the Teva? This glorious, happy-go-lucky, colorful picture of an ark and animals and water, and there's usually a rainbow in the background. It's like this magnificent picture. My kids all have toys with a little toy Noach and a Mrs. Noach and all the animals, and it's so cute. It's a nuclear holocaust. It is destruction. And Noach witnessed the end of all life as he knew it. Total, complete annihilation and destruction. And Chazal hold him accountable. He didn't save anyone, they say. Avraham at least made an effort in saving Sodom. He dealt with the people of his generation. Noach, what happened to you, Noach? The world was destroyed under your watch. You were saved, and your three sons and their families and the rest of mankind is wiped out. Noach did not exit the Teva and build little toys for his children, cutouts of himself and his wife and the animals with a nice little rainbow in the background. The rainbow represented, Noach, I won't destroy the world again, even though you might deserve it. It's my sign to you that I won't put this destruction again. And Noach now steps into a world that is void of life. Totally empty. So that comment is not so much a joke. We have a misconception of what it was like because of the little board games and it's such a ubiquitous concept that you see the ark and it's a happy picture. It's this little boat floating in the water with a rainbow in the background and animals and everyone's smiling and happy. And it was destruction. And Noach lived through that and he now needs to start over. And there are those who do learn exactly as you said, there's a concept of getting drunk, of being able to deal. Now, I don't want to make that sounds unsophisticated, but I just want to throw that as a part of an approach. It's part of a larger approach. Not it on its own. It wasn't just that he gave up and he was sad, but that is part of it. There are those in the Mefarshim who do learn that was part of it. But even with that, the fact that Torah uses the word vayochel, which doesn't just mean that he began, but it also means that he debased himself, Chazal saw that wasn't where he should have started. You don't start with the vineyard. You don't start with that which is going to bring wine and bring intoxication and bring drunkenness into the world. But let's leave that for now. This is what he does. He comes out of the Teva, plants himself a vineyard. Now, Chazal understood that this growth was a miraculous growth and that it happened to have been on the day that he planted, was the day that he harvested, was the day that he made wine, was the day that he drank, and the whole episode happened. So that it had a miraculous aspect to it. It wasn't over months and months and months, but it was almost an immediate, almost like Gan Eden, where also Chazal saw everything was right away for Adam until he sins. There is something else very important in this pasuk. There's a phrase which should grab our attention. Vayochel Noach isha adamah vayita karem.
The man of the earth.
Right? The isha adamah. What was Noach defined? Well, how did the first pasuk of Parsha Noach go? It's an ish tzaddik. The beginning of the Parsha, Ewa told us, Noach, ish tzaddik. We define him as a ish tzaddik, a righteous man. And now Noach comes off of the Teva, and he plants a vineyard, and we call him an ish adama, a man of the earth. Which would you rather be? Are we going upwards or downwards when we go from an ish tzaddik to an ish adama? Something has changed. He's no longer defined as the ish tzaddik. He's now an ish adama. Okay, Chof Aleph. Vayesh min hayayin vayishkar. He drinks of the wine and he becomes drunk. Vayizgal besoich oholo. And he becomes uncovered within his tent. So he's in his tent, he has to drink, and he gets drunk. Now we can ask a question here, whether or not his getting drunk was on purpose or accidental. Meaning to say, is the new world that he lived in somehow fundamentally different, where the nature of wine was different, the strength, or, did he not expect to get drunk and he became drunk? Or was this done more on purpose, in the sense of being more what he'd been through, that he wanted, or whatever he needed to accomplish, that he got drunk on purpose? We could leave that question on the table as well. What's relevant to us right now is he's in his tent, and he gets himself drunk. And not only does he become drunk, he becomes uncovered. So now he's in a position in which he is no longer... debased physical position, in his tent, uncovered, drunk. Very earthy. Chav Beis. Vayar Cham Avi Kenan Es Ervas Oviv. Cham, who is the father of Kenan. Again, we are introduced, Cham was one of Noach's children, Shem, Cham, and Yafes. And here we're introduced again to Cham, and how are we introduced to him? That he is the father of Kenan. He comes in, and he sees the nakedness of his father. Vayaged l'shnei achov b'chutz. And then he goes and tells his two brothers outside. So what's of note in this pasuk? Okay, as we mentioned, correct. The father of Kenan. Why are we told again here that Cham is the father of Kenan? It seems to be of some relevance. What should Cham have done? Covered up his father, right? And what does he do? Goes outside. So, right, there's a passive mistake and an active mistake. The passive mistake was not covering him up. He could have made that mistake and just gone on with his day, and that we still would have said he made a mistake. He passively didn't, he saw, and he didn't do anything. And then, not only does he see and not do anything about that, but then he goes and he tells his two brothers. And where does he tell his brothers? Bachutz, outside. And Ramban sees in that a language of like in a public sort of place, in a way that would even further debase his father, that now Cham comes running out to his brothers, to Yefes, and to Shem, and says, you're not going to believe what I just saw. Dad's in his tent, he's drunk, and he's uncovered. Chav Gimel. Vayikach Shem v'Yofes es hasimla. Shem and Yofes then go and they take a garment. Vayasimu al Shechem Shneihem. And they lay it upon both of their shoulders. Vayelchu achoranis. And they walk backwards. Vayachasu es eros aviyem. And they cover their father's nakedness. Ufneihem achoranis. Their faces were backward. And they saw not their father's nakedness. So what do Shem and Yafes do? So they come, they show respect. Here they have their father in a compromised position, and they go in, and not only do they cover him, but the Torah goes out of its way to stress how they did it, that they covered him in a way that would show respect, that they saw not the nakedness of their father as they did it. They walked in backwards, their faces were backwards. You see the phrase actually appears twice. They walked backwards. Covered their father's nakedness, their faces were backward. They saw not their father. Rashi points out why they say twice, because even as they had to then cover, they would continuously turn whatever they needed to do to be able to cover him in that respectful manner, and not having to in any way compromise their father, always in being able to show him the proper respect while they were doing this. So this is the story. Now we get to Chav Dalet. Vayiketz Noach Mieno. Noach now awakens from his sleep, from his wine. Vayeda es asher asolo b'no hakaton, and he realized what his small son had done to him. What's the problem with this pasuk? Okay.
How does he know which son that it was?
Okay, how does he know what son? Okay, there's a more fundamental problem. He was asleep. No. What do you mean, small son? There's a more fundamental problem.
Well, Ham is not the youngest.
Well, Ham is that's debatable. There's Machlokas Rashi and Rambam exactly how what the order of their sons is.
That's small.
How do we know that something
is done to him? Okay, now the fundamental problem is as follows. When Noah falls asleep, what state is he in? He's drunk and he's naked. When he wakes up, what does he find? He's covered. Should he feel anger or should he feel love? He should feel loved. He should say to himself, who came in here and covered me up? He should feel, I fell asleep, I was in a drunken stupor, I'm not sure, I wasn't covered in this blanket when I went to sleep, I was wearing my clothes, and I'm not wearing my clothes now, but I'm covered in a blanket. And he should feel that somebody came in and took care of him. And he should feel that somebody came in and covered him and did something for him. And what does the Torah say? He woke up and he knew what his small son had done. Now this is not a positive. Because what's the next words out of Noah's mouth in verse Chafei? Vayomer Arur Kenan. Cursed is Kenan. Eved Avodim Yihyeh Le'achav. He should be a servant of servants to his brothers. So he knew that it was the youngest son. Now, the youngest son was Ham, but he doesn't curse Ham, he curses Canaan. So we have to deal with that also, because what's Canaan doing here? Canaan didn't do anything. Ham is the one who saw. Ham, the son, goes and tells his brothers. Noah wakes up and realizes what his small son had done, and he curses Canaan. Why is Canaan getting the curse? Ham should get the curse. Well, that's already getting distracted from the main question, which is, what do you mean that which was done to him? What did he know? What happened over here? He just woke up and he found himself covered. We'll get to that.
Can you know that you were uncovered?
I don't know. I've never really been drunk. I'm being taped. Of course I'm going to say that. The truth is I can't take out Pesach. Is very hard for me. I get
the
sick.
Only grandchild that exists at this time?
Canaan. So there's a machlokas exactly how to handle that as well, because when the Torah lists the genealogy of Ham, which it will do on the top, you don't have a chumash in front of you. I'll read it to you. And the Torah describes here Uvnei Ham. The Torah goes through the genealogy of all of the. You're all familiar with this little map on the bottom. It goes through all the 70 nations who came from Shem, Ham, and Yefes. So it goes through Ham. These were Ham's children. These were Yefes' children. These were Shem's children. These are their grandchildren. So when it goes through the children of Ham, it says as follows: Uvnei Ham, and it lists four children that Ham had. It says as follows: Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, Ukanan. Who would you say is the oldest? This is the list. Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, Canaan. Sounds like Cush. Who's the youngest? Canaan. That's certainly what we would say. And as a proof, if you look at the chart that Artscroll says, they put Ham, and the first name under Ham as number 15 is Cush, then Mitzrayim, then Put, and then Canaan. It would sound from the Chumash that Canaan is actually the fourth child, which would just further the question, if Canaan is the fourth child of Ham, why does the Torah keep introducing Ham as the father of Canaan? Why would Canaan bear the brunt of this curse from his father's actions, and he's the fourth child? And the Torah is entirely silent about this. It just keeps introducing Ham as the father of Canaan. And then when Noah wakes up from his wine and he sees what his little child had done, and he says, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants to his brothers. Where did Canaan fit in? So there are a couple of approaches that the Mefarshim take to this. Ramban takes one approach, which is a novel approach, which he says is pshat, simple meaning of the story is as follows. The Ramban says that Canaan was actually the eldest son of Ham. Why is he listed last? And why does he bear the brunt of these curses? Says the Ramban, the verse, the very first verse, which I very quickly skim through, after Noah and his sons come off of the table, the first thing that Hashem says to them, he says, Vayivorech, this is right after the flood, everything opens up, Vayivorech Elokim es Noach v'es Bonav. Hashem blessed Noah and his children, and he said to them, Pru urvu melu es ha'aretz, fill the world, umorachad v'chit chemil kochaz, and all the animals will fear you. Says the Ramban, if God blesses Noah and Shem and Ham and Yafes, you can't create a bigger force field than that. You might want to curse them all you want, but it's too late because God has already blessed them. And you cannot curse that which has been blessed by the Creator of all blessings. Therefore, says the Ramban, Ham, who only has one child at this point in the story, he suggests, and that would be his eldest, Canaan. He bears the brunt of the curse of his father. Because his father can't be cursed. Who do you curse? The eldest. The eldest always carries on the legacy of the father. That really is the root. The Rabban himself says this as well. Not here, but he says this in the story of Yaakov and Esav. What did Yaakov want to buy that he was buying the birthright? He asks that as a question. What's he buying? So Rabban says, because the firstborn always inherited the stature, the eminence, the position of the father. That's the way that it always went. And Yaakov was going to purchase that from Esav. I'll take that position. Normally it should have been you. I'm going to have it. So therefore, it says the Ramban, as far as Pshat goes, so when Ham makes a mistake, Noah can't curse his son Ham, but he can curse the next best thing, which would be his eldest son, Canaan. Why is Canaan then listed fourth, says the Ramban? Because he's cursed. Once he was cursed, the Torah doesn't, you can't be put first. The first name that's listed as in the genealogy is the position of authority. That's the position of eminence. That's the position of power. So therefore, the Ramban says, he holds his pshat, that what happened was, Ham is the one who made the mistake. He only had one son at the time, the son, which was Canaan. Canaan, therefore, bears the brunt of the curse. And therefore, he's listed last, because he's already been cursed by that point. This happens a couple verses later, and that's why he actually gets the brunt of it. Chazal, that Ramban is just as pshat. Chazal saw another layer in the story, and they say a different approach, which Rashi quotes. And that is, the Torah, when it lists the genealogy, is it, as it lists it. The eldest was actually Cush, then Mitzrayim, then Put, and Canaan. Canaan was actually fourth. If he was fourth, why would he be cursed when, why would he be cursed when Ham is the one who did the action? So they answer that question together with the second question. The other question, I'm going to put all the questions, and we'll see how Chazal answer it. And that was the question that we asked, how did, when Noah wakes up and he realized what had been done to him? I mean, nothing had been done to him. He'd been covered. So why would anything have been, what did he realize? So Chazal say as follows, and we're going through this quickly because this is not this isn't the Hanukkah part of the story. This is just the context of the story, which we'll get to the Hanukkah part of the story. And that is, Canaan was the first one in who saw their father. He was the fourth child of Ham, but he's the one who stumbled into the tent of his grandfather Noach and sees Noach in this manner, uncovered, in a compromised position, and he goes and tells his father Ham. Ham comes in, sees his father, and then does something that Noah realized. And what was that? Chazal say there's a dispute whether or not he simply had relations with his father, or he castrated him. And both opinions say, either way, at the end of the day he castrated him, that he should not have any more children. Meaning that Noah was going to or attempting to have more children, and Canaan saw that, tells his father Ham, and Ham ensured that Noah would never have any more children. Rashi quotes from Chazal, and why would Ham take this action upon himself to make sure that Noah would not have any more children? So Rashi quotes from Chazal, Ham made the following argument. He said, our grandfather, Adam HaRishon, had two children. And they needed to figure out a way to split the world between them. The first two people in mankind's history. And we went from Adam, who had the whole world to himself, to Cain and Hevel. And all that they needed to do was figure out a way to get the whole world divided between the two of them. And what happens? Cain kills Hevel. They can't even figure out a way to do that. Says Ham, our father already has 3 children. And we need to figure out a way to divide up the world. And now he desires to have more. Ham says, I'll put an end to that. There will be no more children from Noah. It'll be these 3 roots and that's it. Takes matters into his own hands, say Chazal, and took care of that. Now many and some learned that that's part of... Noach was drinking, he needed to have more children, Ham doesn't want it, there's a lot going on, but none of this has to do with Hanukkah part of the story, so I'll just whet your appetite if you want to look more into this. There's so much in this little story that's like tucked into Parshas Noach. Everybody focuses on the flood in Noach, and there's a lot of stuff that happens after the flood which needs to be addressed. But in any case, Chazal understood that this is why Canaan gets the curse, because either one approach, but he's the one who first saw it, or Chazal say something else as well that Rashi quotes. Ham was trying to prevent Noah from having a 4th child who would be there to help Noah. So Noah says, your 4th child, Canaan, will therefore be that child who's going to have to now serve everybody else. You prevented the 4th child from being born. Your 4th child will now serve the rest of us, and he becomes the Eved of Adim. He becomes the slave. But that is, either way, that's some of the layers. Either the simple layer of the Ramban, who just learns that Canaan was actually the eldest child who receives the curse because Ham could not be cursed. Canaan, in that way of the Ramban, in that approach, Canaan was actually pretty innocent in the whole thing. He didn't do anything. He just bears the brunt because he's the eldest and replaces the stature of his father. His father was protected by the blessing of God himself. Therefore, Canaan gets the curse, versus the Midrashic approach, which is that Canaan actually had an active role. Canaan actually either saw, tells his father then takes matters into his own hands and says, Noah cannot possibly have any more children, 3 is enough. And then Canaan gets the curse because either he actually started the process, or because he's the 4th child of Ham, the 4th child that Ham was trying to prevent from bringing into the world, and therefore he will be the 4th child, will now serve as a slave to the rest of humanity, serve as a slave to the other brothers. Now again, when I say as a slave to the rest of humanity, remember, these are the only 3 people in the world from which all of humanity will descend. So that if Noah says to one of the 3, or to Canaan, you'll be a slave to your brothers, meaning Shem and Yefes, that's it. That's the rest of the world population. There'll be a chain from, this is now 1 of 4 out of Ham, meaning Ham is 1 of the 3. From him come 4, Cush, Mitzrayim, Put, and Canaan. One of those will be a slave to the rest. It will be one of those lines will be serving the other brothers. Okay, but that's all as far as our main goal, just setting the context of the story. So in 25, in verse Chafei, Vayomer Arur Canaan Eved Avadim Yele Achav. Now we get to our part of the story. Now we have our heroes of the story, which is going to set our stage for our Hanukkah part of the discussion. Shem and Yafes. We have the 2 brothers who come in and cover their father. So Noah has now levied one phrase to his son Ham, and that is that Canaan, his son, will be cursed and he will be slaves. Then he turns to Shem in Chavav in 26, Vayomer, Boruch Hashem Elokei Shem. Blessed is Hashem, the God of Shem, the Canaan Eved Lomo, and let Canaan be a slave to them. What's odd about that pasuk?
Singular
plural. Okay. So let's go on the simplest level, meaning to all of the descendants of Shem. So that's a simple explanation to a lot of discussion. But there's something more fundamentally interesting about this pasuk. How would you have said, what's the goal of this pasuk?
To bless Shem.
Good. Does Noah bless Shem? No, he doesn't. There's no blessing to Shem here. It doesn't seem that way, at least. Right? What's the blessing? What does he say? Blessed is Hashem, who's the God of Shem. Interesting. But his goal is seemingly to bless Shem. Let's leave that for now. Chav Zayin, then he turns to his other son, to Yefes. Yaftelukim li Yefes. Now, Yaft and Yefes, what's the simplest translation of Yaft and Yefes? What does the word Yafe mean?
Nice.
Nice or beautiful. Now, Yaft also means, as Rashi translates here based on the Targum Unglis, to expand or to extend. Yaft Elokim, let Hashem extend or expand Yefes, the boundaries and the borders of Yefes. So here now, Noach turns to his son Yefes and he gives him a blessing that he should be expanded. He should extend. Vayishkon ba'ohole shem, and he should dwell in the tents of shame. V'yichanan eved lamo, and as well, Kanan should be a servant to him as well. Now there's a two-part blessing to Yefes. The first part is the first phrase, Yaft Elokim liYefes, let God extend you, you should expand. And then there's a second phrase, Vayishkon ba'ohole shem, and he shall dwell in the tents of shame. What are the two ways of translating that phrase of Vayishkon be'oyole shame, that he shall dwell in the tents of shame? Right, we could translate that with a capital H or lowercase h. It could either be Yaft Elokim liYefes, let Hashem extend you, Yefes, and Vayishkon, and you, Yefes, shall dwell in the tents of shame. Or we can read it as going back as a capital H and the word Elokim. In other words, in the first phrase, there are two pronouns, Elokim and Yefes. Yaft Elokim liYefes. So the second pronoun, or I should say the third pronoun, there are two proper nouns in the first phrase, Elokim and Yefes. So the first pronoun of Vayishkon, and he shall dwell, which proper noun is that going back on? Is it going back on God, or is that going back on Yefes? Rashi, we will see, as well as the Ramban, read that as a capital H. Yaft Elokim liYefes, God should extend you, v'yishkon be'ohol eshem, and he, God, will dwell in the tents of shame. And Canaan will be a slave to them. And then the Torah concludes that Noach lives and dies, and that's the end of the story of Noach. We now have that Noach is finished as far as his role in the story of the history of the world, and he has now said his peace to his three sons, to Shem, to Ham, and to Yefes. Now those blessings are quite ambiguous. What does it mean, the blessing to Shem of Baruch Hashem Elokei Shem? Blessed is God. Blessed is Hashem, the God of Shem. How is that a blessing to Shem? What does it mean, Yaft Elokim liYefes, you should extend? What does that mean? What does it mean, Vayishkon ba'ohol eshem? Is that a blessing to Yefes, that God should dwell in the tents of shame? Why is that said in Yefes' pasuk? And so there's certainly plenty what to discuss. But what I'd like to discuss now, before we get to those blessings, is there's another series of blessings, so to speak, buried in this story, which does not manifest itself explicitly, but will have a major role in our understanding of that. And that's back in Pasuk Chaf Gimel. There was a major problem which nobody pointed out, but it's only apparent from the Hebrew side of the page. So we'll read that again in Chaf Gimel. Vayikach Shem v'Yefes es hasimlon. Shem and Yefes took a garment. Vayasimu al Shem Shneim, and they placed it on the shoulders of the two of them. And what's the problem with this pasuk? Right, it's singular. Right. How many people are doing the action of taking the garments? Two people. How do you say that they took in Hebrew plural? Vayikchu, they took, the same way that we said vayasimu, and they placed it on their shoulders. It should have said, and they took the garment. But it doesn't say that, it only says vayikach, and he took. And then he took Shem and Yefes. So Rashi points this out on the back side of your page. The first one here on the... No, there's a mistake there. I see it's Chaf Dalet. It should be Chaf Gimel. I apologize about that. Chaf Gimel on the Hebrew side. Rashi says as follows, Vayikach Shem v'Yefes, and Shem and Yefes took. Ein ksiv vayikchu. It doesn't say, as it should, vayikchu, and they both took the garments. Ela vayikach. It says, and he took. Limeid al Shem shenis ametz b'mitzvah yoyser miYefes. We learn from here, says Rashi, that Shem is the one who exerted himself in this mitzvah. Shem is the one who initiated this more than Yefes. How do you know that it was Shem who exerted himself more than Yefes? His name is closer. It says, Vayikach Shem v'Yefes. So since the word Vayikach is singular, what's going to be the object of the word Vayikach? Whose name is going to be there? The first name, Vayikach Shem. So Rashi says the singular is to point out that it was Shem who was much more involved in this than Yefes. Lekach zochu bonov letalis shel tzitzis. And therefore, as a result of this action, that Shem initiated the covering of their father, his children, us, the Jewish people, the Bnei Yisrael, merited the talis of tzitzis, the beged, the garment upon which we will put the strings of our tzitzis. The Yefes. And what about Yefes, who was involved in this, but less involved? He didn't initiate. He was a little bit more passive. Shem said, hey Yefes, we can't let Dad stay like this. Come, let's take the garment and cover him. And Yefes says, great idea. While Ham is off laughing in a corner. So Ham gets cursed. And Shem and Yefes get blessings. But Shem's blessing is different because he initiated. Vayikach. Shem is the one who went and took the garment and said, Yefes, come, let's go. Now Yefes went along. Yefes didn't go with Ham laughing. Yefes comes together with Shem. So what does Yefes get out of this? Says Rashi, V'Yefes zocha l'kvuro l'bonov. He merited burial for his children. Shenei Amar, quoting a pasuk from Yechezkel, Etein l'gog makom shom kever. I will give to Gog a place there for a tomb in a certain war that takes place in the Navi. His children of Yefes will merit burial for the dead of the war because of the episode, that which Yefes did in taking this garment together with Shem and covering up their father.
How does that connect?
Oh, you took the question right out of my mouth. Have you been in this class before? Let's just finish. V'chom Shebizas Alvi Ben-Cham, who disgraced his father, so on him, Kain Yinoig Melech Ashur Shvi Mitzrayim, the king of Assyria, will lead the captives of Egypt and the exiles of Cush, young ones and old ones, tattered, barefoot and bare. That's what Ham is going to get. Now, this Rashi, based on Chazal, is saying, this is above and beyond, something different from actually what Noach says. Noach, at the end of the story, gives his own blessings. He gives a blessing to Shem. Baruch Hashem Elokei Shem, blessed is Hashem, the God of Shem. Vayishkon ba'ohol Hashem, and God should dwell in your tents. And Yefes gets a blessing, Yaftelokim li'Yefes, God should extend you. And besides for the blessing that Noach gives to the children, their acts merit something else buried within the story. Shem, who initiates, gets the beged of tzitzis, the talus, the clothing upon which we put our tzitzis. And Yefes gets burial. What in the world does this have to do that Shem should get the beged of tzitzis and Yefes should get burial? What's the deal? Why do they get those things? Let's break it down and say, first of all, what's the difference between the beged, that which Shem merits? There are two distinctions, two additional elements, two milas, two benefits, though you almost would say, that Shem's blessing carries that Yefes doesn't have. What's the benefit of having the beged of tzitzis versus burial? Excellent. Number one, the beged of tzitzis supplies during one's life. Whereas burial, by definition, only applies after one's life. So that Shem merited something that his children would have already during their lifetime. And Yefes merits something only which will take place after death.
And yet, in a Jewish burial, even though we make it muscle, Jewish burial is
out. Okay. We'll see if we can tie that in. But what else is different between meriting the beged of tzitzis and burial? Close, you're on the right track.
Tzitzis comes in mitzvah.
Excellent. Tzitzis is a mitzvah. Burial, whereas we have, there's a mitzvah on us, the living, to bury the dead, but that's not what Yefes is meriting. What's Yefes meriting? To be buried. That's not a fulfillment of a mitzvah. He's meriting a certain honor. He did something, and he is honored in return. And as opposed to having his body left out in the streets, he merits that his children, his descendants from him, will be buried. It's an honor that he gets, but it's not a mitzvah. Shame, on the other hand, merits the beged of tzitzis. So not only does shame merit something which applies during his lifetime, that which applies during his lifetime is also a mitzvah. Yefes merits something which will only apply after he's dead, and it's not a mitzvah, it's just the element of kavod, of honor. Says the Maharal, what's the difference and why are they getting these two things, the beged of tzitzis and burial? What did Shem and Yefes do for their father? They bestowed kavod, they bestowed honor to their father who was in a compromised position, who was in an unhonorable place, in a dishonorable kind of, naked and uncovered and drunk in his tent, and Ham is laughing and sneering in the corner, and Shem and Yefes say, this is not right. And we're going to bestow kavod, we're going to bestow honor and cover our father. But shame initiates. Yefes goes along. Says the Maharal, shame, therefore, is going to get something which will reflect the combination of his guf and his neshama together. They both honored the guf, but shame, when he honored the guf, the body of his father, Noach, initiates that. Where does that come from, that initiation? So because he initiated it, what he is going to get will be something which will reflect both his guf for honoring his father's body, but also his neshama. And therefore, what he will merit will be something, the beged of tzitzis, the beged of something which clothes the person. Person's clothing is always referred to in the Gemara as his kavod, as his honor. The clothing that we wear is a symbol of our honor. As human beings, as a Tzelem Elokim, we have our clothing. And the type of clothing that a person just wears is his sign of kavod. So he merits the beged of tzitzis. And the way that he gets clothing, the way that he gets this honor, is in a way that he will do it in his lifetime, while his neshama and his guf are still together, and it will be in the form of a mitzvah. So that a mitzvah obviously always also refers to the combination of that which the neshama is doing, that the soul is doing as part of the action. Not just a physical action, but an action which contains the element of the spiritual of the neshama in it as well. Yefes is passive. It's not his idea. He just says, oh, I'll go along with that. So what does he get? He gets kavod, but only for the guf. He gets kavod for the guf, not during his lifetime when his neshama is together with his guf. He gets it only for the guf alone after the neshama has already been taken out. And it's not in the fulfillment of a mitzvah. It's just simply, your guf will also be honored. You honored your father, but you just went along with it. It's as if your body went along. It wasn't your idea. It wasn't your initiation. It wasn't your neshama. Yefes, shame came up with the idea, you went along with it, so the merit, the schus that you will get, will therefore be your guf and your guf alone. Therefore, in the form of burial post-death, when the neshama is no longer a part of it, and it will not be the fulfillment of the mitzvah, it will just be, we will honor your body as you honored your father's body. Shame, who initiates, the creative one, the one who brings this idea into the world, is therefore given the same cover, the covering of the body, but not just the covering of the body with earth post-death, but the covering of the body during his lifetime with his neshama in the form of a mitzvah. So says the Maharal, is why these specific things were chosen to honor the bodies of Shem with a beged, and to honor Yefes with burial, but in different forms, one during life as a mitzvah, one in death. I will leave you with that thought.
But that's the Hanukkah.
Well, I have a whole nother hour, but we're getting there, yeah. But
forget like that.
I'll put online, you'll listen to it right before next week. So what we have here is the beginnings of Shem, Ham, and Yefes. We now have half of the story of the zchus, the merits that Shem and Yefes get through this action. And next thing what we'll do is go through the bracha
that Noah gives to them, and as how we will see these elements reflecting the Greek Jewish ideology of the Hanukkah story, and how the blessings of Noah tie them in of Yafta Lokim Liepes, where it is that we can take the beauty of Greece and write a Sefer Torah with it, how that will come to play. We'll finish that Mirat Hashem next week.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.